First of all, for the record, I've been saying for 10 years that I wish the word function would have been extirpated from the wetland glossary, number one. Number two, I like what you're saying, Rich, a lot. The only problem I see
See, there's only one flaw. That's the only flaw.
The only problem I see is, you flashed up all those numbers for those specific wetlands in that one slide. Generally, I believe that the assessment approach you're using to do that assessment is a site-specific assessment of some kind in most cases. Now, maybe you aren't, but what I would say is that the hurdle we need to get over is a way to figure out to do the assessment that indeed integrates across the entire watershed or landscape that's being assessed, how you take that information and bring it back to whatever your assessment unit is.
I'll leave that to Eric and Josh, because that was their California Rapid Assessment, how they consider that. But the one thing I want to make, and there is a storyline of how within a site-specific assessment you can capture through landscape indicators. Usually it looks at disturbance features in the surrounding area and picks up the information that way. But I want to make a point there, and I think it's a very important point. We raised this in California. I think Eric and Josh were there. Obviously, we're there. In Sacramento District, we were meeting on this rapid assessment method, is this condition function issue. And within the core regs, and this is one of the problems, I'm glad you're here, Dan, is that it says in awful policy that you have to evaluate function. And we see that in a lot of state regs too, state assessment methods. Now here's the kick, is that if you consider ecological integrity a super function, Dan Smith, I forget what year. or was it Brinson or both of you? I'm not sure. Both of you said this. It becomes a super function. So we begin to say, how do I, Rich, you're saying do condition assessment. I'm bound by rule to do functional assessment, and I have to do kind of some other approach. And so I say, no, you can do a condition assessment. Think of it as ecological integrity as being a super function, and that you're assessing that particular function. And we then crosswalk into the word condition. So those who and maybe Josh or Eric can comment on that, when we had San Francisco District was there, LA District, and Sacramento District, all three districts, they didn't think they had a problem once we made that connection over. I don't know, what do you think? Eric, because you're more of a... how's that function condition thing? Because I think in order to do some of this, the innovation, to quickly, create these maps, to do a condition assessment. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I think it's semantics, function, condition, potato, potato, right? But I think the point is it's the issue of scale, which Dan made, is it has to be sort of a feedback here, because the conditions at the site influence the conditions of the landscape, and vice versa. The conditions of the landscape influence the conditions of the site. And so sort of the operational paradigm we were trying to articulate in Sacramento is that you really have to be able to move back and forth between these two scales. So the map that you put up that Josh generated basically is saying that landscape, the condition of the landscape, is influenced by those site-specific conditions, and vice versa, they reflect the condition of the landscape. And so you really need, in a sense, multiple tools that you can look at to say, okay, if we're trying to do mitigation in a watershed context, we have to understand the context of the city, but we also have to understand the condition of the individual pieces.
Right. And as a quick surrogate, we often use land use, land cover in the surrounding that wetland as a surrogate to give us that landscape. Because again, it is that human disturbance that actually has such an overwhelming effect on what's happening in that wetland itself. So that becomes the quick surrogate. And we have actually a whole line of new work going on, working on landscape development indices. I'm going to
take any more questions.
Sure.
I'm gonna ask Barbara to come up here too.
Okay.
We have about half an hour for questions and for Barbara and Rich to respond. So I wanna make sure that they both are very clear targets in here. Molly, Bill, and then Josh.
I love the second thing you showed that had all of the watersheds. Is it the state of Iowa?
That was the other one.
Yeah,
the West kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to get one of those.
Through
the Bay Area, our district. Okay. And so, in regard to going through all this process and getting to the end product, in the areas I work, which is the urbanized area, So when you went through that process with your sample watershed and came to the end, and then you called up all of the places where there was agriculture and industry and those kinds of things, I can just look at a map of Contra Costa County.
Sure.
And I know where that stuff is, and I can see it, and we can see where the, you know, where the regional parks are. And
Apparently
we're not allowed to do anything in there because those are already preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so then it comes down to, so what I would do is ask the consultants to find the closest site where they are. If they can't do something on site, now we're talking about having to go somewhere else. Or if you're on site, can they do something? Is there enough tape on site that would fit the kind of underfilling, that kind of thing? So then they would have to find, if they're going off-site, what is actually available to them, a willing seller and all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
So, and you showed the example of the two wetlands, the one that was very close up.
Yeah, right.
That was just single, and the one that was stretched out.
Right.
And I just did that at one of the
Okay.
Their proposal is, I looked at it, I said, look, this, you know, this looks like a linear feature, not a wetland. Why are they just doing a wetland? So then we figured out, and then went back to the consultants, they figured out how it could be a linear feature. So that's how I would do things. And I think at this point, so far, in an urbanizing, an urbanized landscape, that I would end up at a similar place that you would using all of these layers, without having to use all the layers.
Uh-huh. Well, you're using the same principles, yeah.
I mean,
so you're going to say, I mean, in your mind, and somebody was saying is that I think we, within each of our watersheds, we have kind of a watershed plan. Even as an individual, I walk into my Dixon Creek or Mary's River water, I know how I would do it. And I think that's what you're going into place. Now, I would say, okay, find the relatively intact things, because that's where you're likely to have, you know, be able to grow. The little difference is that when they come in for a plan, often we go in and say, I want you to build me a wetland that has these functions, as opposed to saying, build me a hydrogeomorphic wetland that has these features, which you can go back to guidebooks and get like what the structural features are, and then say, give me this class of wetland in this particular place, and give it to me in pretty good condition. And I think that's how I would simplify. I mean, I would kind of go in that storyline and maybe embellish your story a little bit more. And that's usually what you do. Because you're not going to go out after, if you've done a mitigation project, and I've spent on it all, it's like you're not sitting there going, wow, I think this, looking at 12 HGM functions, this is a 664432 wetland. You're going, where are the plants, man? Who are the plants? Where's the water? And so we're looking for some first, you know, simplify this thing a little bit and see if we have at least some water, right hydrodynamic, and you know, the right shape, which gives you the plan. But I think you're on the right, it's the right track. You know, that's what we're doing,
And then Josh. In developing a profile, I think the wetland profiling concept is pretty cool. We've taken a step with this. And the devil's always in the details. When you assume a historic profile, what do you go to?
Okay, what Brad did in that case was go. He did a paired watershed approach. I mean, he in this part of the Rocky Mountains, he went to a watershed that didn't have the roads, didn't have, like I said, as much disturbance, and actually looked at the profile there and used that as kind of beginning his benchmark. So you could do a paired watershed approach, same ecoregion, perhaps same basin, perhaps even same planning area, political bounded planning area to get at, as it were. The other part, which is even the simpler, is if this is the only profile I have left, don't degrade it further. So, I mean, I know what you're saying is, like, if I want to essentially see if my watershed is getting better, I'm actually, what's my target profile? What do I really want based on historic or something? How do I set? But, you know, I think one is to do the paired watershed approach, give you some clues, which you can actually crank out profiles, and this is what we want to do, people like John Hall and with NWI folks, is, I mean, with HGM modifiers,
you can walk into. Oh, maybe you can help me out here. How fast can you punch out a profile once you have? You've done this profiling stuff. I mean,
the area, the scale, the level of detail.
These are not. No, but you know. But with the modifiers on.
With the modifiers on. I mean, if you look at one map, if someone just sat down and added things, I mean, in an afternoon they could do that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me just say, so, if you go back to an NWI base for your landscape profile. One of the things that you have to account for, which happens in the Georgia Piedmont, is that that's a fairly recent snapshot, and that things have changed even before that snapshot was taken. So in other words, you don't have the complete picture of where to put that weapon back in that profile. And then to complicate that, there's a temporal factor, which in the Piedmont, streams are downcutting, so areas that are identified as floodplain wetlands may not be connected to the stream anymore because the stream is down.
I think this is where we get into, what about my particular location? I have particular issues. I think, and so when we have to drop into a watershed, and we have, if we have these complexities, we have to deal with them through some more rigorous analysis. I mean, I'm trying to keep this first principles. I can't. I mean, if we get into profiles. We're going to get into what about this, what about that. But I'm just saying, back to the regulator side, it's like the 3-8 HGM class. What has been historically? What kind of HGM wetlands do you have in your wetland watershed? What Mary Cantula has found in many states over and over again, as they look at the mitigation projects, is they're building atypical wetlands. They can't even figure out what HGM class they are. I mean, if they can find the wetland to begin with. So, I mean, I'm just sitting there. First principles is like, what classes do you think are here? Get me one of those back, and then they're going to say, well, what design do I use to get an HGM? And then I'm going to go back to the guidebooks and say, maybe there's some clues there in the hydrogeomorph in the HGM guidebooks to give me a design clues. I don't know if you can
look at me.
Well, no, I just and another question for you.
I just want to add one more thing. Dan has been saying for 10 years we should get rid of function.
I have a question. Can you do that for me? I have a question for Ken Brazels. See, I set you up. No, this goes back. One of the issues, and it goes out to Molly, when you see those large-scale maps, and the thing, I'm going to raise a little attention here to Ken, because Arkansas has been essentially a national leader in the way they've been using landscape, developing landscape assessment tools and developing maps, and essentially at that scale, large scale. And the question is to you, Ken, the use of that kind of information, that broad scale, and bringing it right down to a practitioner, what's been your experience in seeing your information, your large landscape GIS-based information, make an environmental effect on the field? I mean, do you see that happening? What's your... I mean, we're supposed to talk about science. That's about.
Well, that's a very broad question, and it goes back to location, 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 I guess. For us, that is one component, I think, Rich, of several tools that we are developing and trying to integrate that will make the practicality of it and the analytical tools that GIS is offering us, and some of those things are evolving as we speak as far as new capacities, canned programming that, as long as you have data to input, you can get something out, or you can develop some a framework from which someone can look at or evaluate a lot of these different factors in relation to one another, and then take that down to, if you're in the regulatory community or non-regulatory community, and you're looking at where do we mitigate, what kind of cumulative impacts do we see in this particular area, and then what along what you've been saying, what type of wetland was there or we would expect would have been there if we can't actually go back and see if our frame of reference is not 200 years ago or whatever, then to me, if you can develop those tools, the practicality is it gives people who are implementing programs just that much more, power to base or to guide their way of viewing and hopefully over time, as you create the baseline, then you have created a logical approach of something that is defensible from a, not necessarily from the tedium of scientific specifics of debating every fine point, but that you've created the framework by which a common person who maybe be looking at whatever program you're implementing can say, this was a logical approach, this makes sense, and this this is something that's semi-defensible. How we've seen what we have seen with developing the one individual tool where we're able to prioritize, if you will, restoration and protection based on landscape features, is we see that implemented in these maps, and that the core permit writers actually are asking us for to see these maps. To look at, for them to help them evaluate cumulative, what's going on cumulatively, and help them to better document cumulative impacts. And then if we're looking at locating mitigation banks, then we're able to look at that, these maps, and see on a broad scale that these are emphasis areas, if you will. So it's being used, but I think it's just one piece of a multitude of tools that hopefully will be integrated to here as we continue to develop this thing.
So first, I want to just summarize. Bill, your question was kind of about historic profiles for reference sites.
Yeah, if the idea is to restore them,
right,
the profile, to have a template.
And I just wanted to see if Barbara had anything she wanted to add on that.
Depends on where you are in the country. Some places have really good records, and other parts of the country don't. And if you're in a really disturbed area, Los Angeles County, you probably don't have a very good idea of what was there. But if you're in southern Wisconsin, you have a very good idea of what was there. The basic principle that I try to work with, and I agree with Dan, way with the function concept, is if it's in the right hydrogeologic setting and it's the right HGM, then you're going to get a gem, as Rich refers to them. I think the other resource that's available in many states are the natural heritage programs, who make explicit effort to identify the best examples of all of the natural communities within their state. So most states have natural heritage programs. Depending upon the state, the examples of the gem, at least, if not the original profile.
I'm going to, we actually going to have a really long discussion also on data and where to find this data and its limitations and its expenses and things like that a little bit later. I have in my queue Josh, then Richard, then Eric. Josh.
Going back to what Dan was saying, but I think most of it was in what Rich was presenting to us, there's this tension as we try to operationalize at the watershed or even regional scale
to cover more areas, there's the same amount of money and the same amount of people, and it requires a certain amount of elegance. And so we're looking for these integrative measures, and it gets away from functions, because in the guy, you just start piling function on top of function almost exponentially as you increase the area. And so we end up looking back at habitat, and then making some very large assumptions about the function relative to habitat condition being size, okay, as well as structure. So the IBI is very important there. But at some point, we still have to say, see, I hate doing this, but what are the key functions I care about? And it does vary from region to region. In our region, we have a few bird species we care about, a few amphibian species. We can develop relationships between condition assessment an actual survivorship or density of recruitment for those key functions, maybe hydrological too, and then live with it and hope that they get everything else. But a word of
consideration. Because of the multiple functions you have to consider, oftentimes you end up focusing more on one, and you have some.
Well, you end up looking at structure, yeah, in order to gain the respect of scientists, keep them at the table, and also be defensible when you get challenged anywhere, you have to be able to show some quantitative data that relate your rapid assessment, your integrative measure, to something real on the ground that people care about. It can be a charismatic concern. Mm-hmm. The other thing that slightly more encouraging, perhaps, is this business of historical ecology. Now, when I developed an historical ecology program for the Bay Area, I did so tongue-in-cheek. I thought we'll never discover what we lost, because we lost it, like, in a year and a half with the gold rush. Everything changed. We killed out whole tribes of people, and we horrifically modified the physical ecosystem. 5 years later, we have a picture of the landscape before European contact, with almost 20,000 independent pieces of evidence, from diaries to landscape photos to cores from marshes. So it can be done. You can recover that picture. You also can't reach the past. So what you do with that picture is something interesting in the concept of reference. But a note of encouragement, you can get a picture of the way things used to be. Picture is something, I think you can do this anywhere, even in the LAPs.
We have Richard and then Eric.
Okay, two.
And then
I go back to Barbara, your tile mosaic. I'm concerned that we're not looking at the landscape long enough and we're jumping to wetlands. I sense that we zero in on one tile or one piece of that grapevine and not the extent of the whole mosaic that was just a very small picture. We are learning, at least in our work in Washington State, that we need to take a look at, and Rich commented on this, ecological processes, things like the delivery and routing of water and how humans have altered that. Wetlands play a key part in how water is delivered to a stream system and water and how water is routed through. The same with nutrients, toxicants, large wood, sediment, heat, some of the key processes that are working in Washington State. We look at that first and then look at how wetlands play a role in those processes. And we can integrate human influence as well as physical features of the landscape as well. So I caution us to zero in right on wetlands. The second thing that we're learning in Washington State is that as it's important to look, I learn different things at different scales, I also need to look at different temporal scales as well. We look back at how systems look like pre-European development, look currently, and then use some of our GMA development to look at how the system will look in the future in a build-out scenario, and then take a look at how processes have changed over time. And that gives us a real important picture, and I think it relates to some of the, we're interested in spatial, we need to also address the temporal aspects.
I'd like to respond to one part of your comment. Again, when we begin to put wetlands in a watershed context, as Sue Elston and I learned in Blackberry Creek, you end up planning the whole watershed. that's what you eventually have to do. And that's where we have to begin to partner, which just isn't a wetland program. But we have to start that circle, start that discussion by saying, here are the wetlands, because that's our authority. And then it's like, these are the gems within the green infrastructure. So then we have to put those little dots within the belts, within the patches, cover all of those, which become the green, the whole open space plan, and see which buffers all those aquatic resources and all those even relatively intact terrestrial resources away from human disturbance. So we have to create those patterns. And I think there's an interplay, and this is what we've been going around for years with our friends in the Department of Ecology, is that I think you can start with, give me the map, give me the basic structure of what you think is right, and then over time, through learning by doing an adaptive management, we can see if we are indeed getting the processes back. Can we do a monitoring and assessment program, which hasn't come up yet, so I'm going to raise it. Monitoring assessment is a big deal that we'll get into somewhere down the course in the next 3 days, is to see if we put this structure back, are we indeed getting the processes back? Are we getting the return on investment? And I would say, let's start with the structure. Let's start with the first approximation of maps, and then put a monitoring assessment program in place to see if we get the processes, and then toggle back and forth. So we'll reconcile that in a couple, 3 weeks
Clean Water Act is clearly the driver, but we can't, from a science-based standpoint, we can't limit our scope if we're really trying to recover natural systems. And I think that's our goal. We're using the Clean Water Act and other tools to do that. Then we need to figure out how the Clean Water Act fits in a larger planning effort rather than making the Clean Water Act try and drive ecosystem recovery. There's a big difference there.
If you're being made to hear it, I'd like to ask John Hall a question.
Is there somebody? No, there's a bunch of people.
Okay, sorry.
You can ask me later.
I can ask you later. Okay.
Eric?
So I just want to respond a little bit to Bill, and it echoes a little bit of what Josh responded to Bill on. In the Willamette Valley of Oregon, the entire Willamette Valley, Nature Conservancy and National Heritage Program staff reconstructed the historic vegetation between, their data was from between 1850 and about 1890, using General Land Office survey notes. And we found that to be incredibly helpful. It's been used not only for the Western New Village program, but for a whole bunch of region-wide analyses that have been done recently. It really helps when you can compare existing vegetation to the best of what that historic vegetation data can tell you. And it really provides that nice analysis ability of current to existing and what can we do to fill in some of the patches between the gems that exist and where there's no gems but opportunities.
And those land office surveys are available for all of the original 13 colonies. And they were for years popular master's projects for the universities in various states. So that's where you find them.
Did you do this as your master's project? Is what you were saying?
And they're of differential quality.
Andy?
I must admit, I'm an HDM user. I've been for years. And we pay attention a lot to the function part of it. And I feel like I'm starting to get at least a mental picture on it. I wasn't paying attention correctly enough, and condition has crept into the lexicon. I never quite understood condition, and I picked up this recent document in the back.
Yeah.
If I can quote one sentence, this condition can be defined as the relative ability of a wetland to support and maintain its complexity and capacity for self-organization with respect to species composition, physical chemical characteristics, and functional processes, unfolded, italicized, as compared to wetlands of a similar class without human alteration. We're not getting out of function. I'm hearing us trying to back away from function here because it's apparently a very difficult thing to get at, and I don't mind that. And it seems like we're going back to indices in a way, which is what condition appears to be. It's a number between 0 and 1, I think.
What?
I think it's a mistake to completely lose this idea of function. We've got to get...
Sure.
And I can go to some litigation sites in Pennsylvania, for example. Few that meet this characteristic. Go to some, you can look at them, and they look great. But as people like Troy Zedler have shown, you can go back to some salt marshes, too, that look great, and they don't function like the ones that were messed up in development. We've got to keep looking at function.
Sure.
We just can't rely on condition as an index.
Here's how that story goes. Coming out of that report, is that the HGM class, the classification system is very powerful because it is a functional classification system, which means that when I stand in a riverine wetland within a certain hydrogeologic setting or ecoregion, as it were, and stand on reference sites, I can then evaluate the functions of that wetland. Riverine wetlands in this ecoregion provide these functions and services, and I can do a complete it's an icon thing. Here's another guy. Okay. You can do a complete suite of what functions should be normally attributed to a good condition riverine wetland in this setting. Okay. Once I know that, then I can go to other wetlands, because I have that reference in my mind, okay? I can go out to another wetland and say, this is the same class of wetland in the same ecoregion, And rather than doing all the functional assessment stuff all over again, because I know one in good condition should have these functions, I can just kind of jump over a couple steps and say, hey, this is in good condition for the report. And that's, yeah.
But
yes.
I think a lot of what we do in HGM so far has been structural and not functional. And I think we need to begin to look at a lot of those structural characteristics and begin to relate them to these functional processes. And once we get to that, I completely agree with that.
Okay, good. So what I'd say is we have a program in place, which EPA does fund through the states through grant programs, to say go out to your HGM class wetlands that you have within your state, within some ecoregion. Find those reference sites and go ahead and do the detailed monitoring and assessment on those reference sites so that you can figure out, looking at that structure, what, and I think Josh was getting at that, what kind of species, what actually, or services, or shall I, because I'm an EPA person, what beneficial uses, there's a new word, can I apply to that particular system? And I think we do that. We have to fund that. And within those domains and for those profiles, for each of those classes, somewhere within Colorado, somebody has to be standing on one of those reference riverine wetland sites and telling us what is the expectation, what comes off of that, what functions, what good is that particular wetland. So we need to do that.
We can't lose that.
We will not lose that.
You'll be receiving a call from Andy.
Well, it depends on what's... Okay. Oh, and yeah.
the report that he was reading from is Review of Rapid Assessment Methods for Assessing Wetland Conditions. It's March 2004, Ottawa Presses. Siobhan, Tennessee, Amy Jacobs, and Mary Cantula. We have some in the back of the room, and I think we have a bunch in the back of the room. Probably almost enough for everyone, so you're welcome to take one.
Okay.
I've got John Hall and Mike Harris-Solomon on the
I don't know where to start. Well, I wasted a lot of time and money doing it, but I learned a lot too. That's you know, we're a learning organization. That's what they tell us. I'm just going to mention some issues, I find this really stimulating. I really appreciate both your talks because it you really have made me as old as I am, I'm still thinking. First of all, it's no question that we have to consider the entire sort of hydrologic cycle, surface water, groundwater, precipitation, whatever. I'm afraid as a regulator, at least in the 404 program, I've always been taught that the Clean Water Act is primarily a surface water act, and that there are other federal laws that control or maybe can regulate those other components of the hydrologic cycle. Another legal, I don't know whether it's an artificiality or whatever it is, and you just mentioned it yourself, that determining where you want to mitigate in a watershed is wonderful, but as you really get into it, what you do is you find yourself, as you said, you basically find yourself coming up with a plan for the watershed. And that's, for those of you who have had to deal with states or counties, when you're trying to do this kind of thing, you very rapidly come to realize that that's a state and local rights issue that is almost insurmountable. Even though you try to help them. You know, I'm here from the, yeah, whatever. The discussion on functional assessment versus condition function, to me, we've got to figure out what to do and maybe somehow to blend them together, because I think the way we've been headed is first of all in the Corps regulations in 320.4 someplace there's a list of I don't know however many functions, and so we've sort of been trained, at least us in the Corps of Engineers, to look at those functions, and we have an awful lot of and you're there, Dan, and you had predecessors, and we've really gotten into this sort of functions, but what I see us doing is coming up with all these functions and maybe coming up with measurements of functions, and then what do we do with them? We just sort of lump them all together and go with habitat. And that's okay. And that's and I guess that's okay. But maybe are we fooling ourselves? I mean, maybe is it better to go to this sort of condition function? But I'm afraid if you go back to some of the legal stuff, if you try to deny a permit based on condition function, you're gonna have a harder time defending it than if you're saying you have lost these specific functions and you have not replaced them to the level of insignificance. That's a regulator talking, okay? Okay. So that we've got to figure out something, you know, some way to deal with that. On the scale stuff, I'm probably just shooting my mouth off here, but we could talk about these for days and days and days. I'm a lover of GPS technology, and all the current technology is very much like this scale thing we're talking about, where you can start out with a picture on your GPS of a map of the major highway systems in the United States, and as you zoom in, slowly but surely you pick up more detail until you start picking up county roads, then local roads, and then you actually pick up the service stations and the restaurants and the hospitals and all of that. So I think we need to keep that in our minds as we think about this scale thing. We've got to start somewhere, and starting with a big scale, I think, is as good a place as by big scale, I mean, you know, big area kind of thing. That's okay to start there with whatever information we have, because we really need this, and then we'll have to refine it. So as we drill down, we'll have that greater level of detail. There are some other advantages, I think, to this approach. I mean, we're talking about using this information to locate mitigation. There are two other really big uses of it in a regulatory context, and one of them is if we can use this kind of information to support permit denials, if in fact that's where we go because of the difficulty or impossibility of replacing the aquatic resource. The other thing that I think this kind of information is extremely important for is that if you have looked at the history of complaints about the Corps' regulatory program from developers, it takes too much time and there's no predictability. You can bring predictability that if you, and you're again, you're skating on thin ice here maybe, but you can bring predictability with these kinds of GIS resources or watershed profiles or whatever they are, so that as people are looking at places to make anthropogenic changes, they can realize that, hey, if they do it there, they could run into a buzzsaw. And so, I mean, all of these things, maybe we all think about these all the time, but I'm trying to sort of put them all together to stress the importance of, I think, what we're here for and the direction we need to go. That's...
I meant to hold up a document that anyone working in wetlands or rivers should get a hold of, which is a publication called Surface Water, Groundwater, a Single Resource.
Oh, I don't disagree.
And so what I tried to show is that groundwater ends up as surface water, and surface water ends up as groundwater, so that if our concern is surface water, we have to be thinking about groundwater. And then on some of the later things you were saying, the individual permit evaluator works within a broader context. And the Adirondack Park Agency in New York has developed a system for their permit evaluators. They have a GIS system. They have people qualified that are on staff to work with that GIS system, and their permit evaluators can go into that system. It's called a lookup system, mm-hmm. and they can see on that GIS they can find the watershed, they can find what permits were granted for what size was the permit granted for, where the wetlands, where the streams, you know, et cetera. And the person who's actually doing that graduated from
Cornell University 2 years ago, and I can tell you that in part we're really working into the future. The students in my landscape impact analysis class, in 4 months, while taking 16 to 18 credits, can take a landscape, can locate the GIS data relevant to that landscape, can download it into ArcView, and begin working with it and do an impact assessment for a watershed. And they knew relatively little coming into the course. So we're putting people out there mm-hmm. who have those skills. And, you know, 5-6 years ago, we were saying, should we require all of our students to have a computer programming course? Well, it's changing so fast, so that, you know, in the future, a permit evaluator has someone in your agency that they can go to and say, put this permit on the ground.
Well, in fact, in Florida, where I'm from, we have that now, mm-hmm. and we have it in large part because of EPA grants to the state of Florida.
Well, that's why EPA has their GIS.
Yeah, and so we literally do have on every project manager's desk an ability to pull up, you know, to pull up what is called in that system or a resources at risk report that can show you, you know, cultural resources, past permitting history, all that kind of stuff. And it's great. What you have to do then is you have to, and this is part of, you know, the technology transfer or the reprogramming of our folks. We need to, and that's what, at least at my level, I try to do every time I meet with our folks, is that you really have to look at this stuff from a basin or a watershed perspective. Use these tools, and we've actually built it into our decision document template mm-hmm. that they have to. They have to do it to answer some fundamental questions about cumulative impact assessment and everything mm-hmm. else.
I want to see, Kara's got a question, and we only have about another 3 minutes or so for questions for these two, although they'll be around further drilling later, I'm sure. But, Kara.
Thank you. Actually, I have HGM curves in my presentation, but I didn't even know it, so. I guess I have a question, and again, I'm at a county level, and through your talk, I'm trying to imagine, we have a proposed project involved in southern Alabama, where they want to build a large subdivision, 10,000 acre subdivision, which is still 4,000 acres of land. So I'm trying to think of how we're going to find that. And I guess and another issue that hasn't been mentioned yet, and it might, is just the public perception to the loss of those wetlands. Mm-hmm. It needs to be close by, you know, for some time down the road. Sure. And that's as a county, being in a county, I don't want to say I want to do it in a large basin area. I don't want the mitigation to go across the bay down the road. I want it to be nearby so that if we're losing all those functions or everything, we want it to be close. So I just felt that was something lacking. Uh-huh. But to my question that was more specific is that, and again, I'm at a county level and I'm in mm-hmm. the coastal plain and we've got lots of wetlands. 30% of our land area is wetlands. But as you go up in different HUD codes, our HGM curve changes dramatically. And I just looked, and it's incredible how that happens. It varies dramatically just because we're in such a smaller scale. When I go from a 10 digit to 14, I actually have the data and just play with it, and it does. It changes. It zigzags around. So I can see that from a regulatory perspective when you're dealing with a 10,000 acre subdivision, that they're going to make that work to however they want it to work. So my question is that similar in other places? Mr. Tyner might be able to help. As you go in higher, like lower in your HUD code, do the HGM curves stay the same?
I would imagine they would be different. Uh-huh. For example, when you look at your headwater some basins up there, they're going to have different characteristics than if you were to look at all waters. The more sub-basins you add, the more diversity you'll potentially have, and you'll end up in, like in our area, we'll start up in headwaters, and we're into a lot of the riverine, and then we get down to the estuarine, and so on. So if you build the whole thing, you've got the most diverse group. So from a mitigation standpoint, if you wanted to mitigate for wetlands in a particular area, I'd go to the lowest
possible
sub-basin and use that as your profile, and then figure out what wetlands you should be responding to.
Well, yeah, I think what happens in the case is as you go up your watershed scale, you're crossing ecoregions or domain, hydrogeologic domains, and so you have to keep. So that's the problem with this hierarchy of watersheds is that you have to say, did I just jump from one ecoregion to the other? If you saw the map there of Colorado, that was all those different colors, different elevations is what you were actually seeing there. And so the profile, and actually I showed two profiles, they were different from 6,000 to 8,000 feet versus 8,000 to 10,000 feet. I mean, obviously they would change. And so if you're using you as a benchmark, what my profile is, you have to stay within that same domain, as it were. That's the jump part, as it were. So. You,